I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So where are we? As we continue to ride the bucking bronco of news this week, here's what we know. Majority Leader Harry Reid says there will be a vote on the proposed bailout tomorrow at 10:30. And reversing course, John McCain says he will attend the first presidential debate tonight in Mississippi. We'll have more on that. But President Bush also spoke for one terse minute this morning, appealing to Congress to move quickly. And later in the morning, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, a Democrat, spoke to reporters about profound disagreements that remain over the president's $700 billion plan to buy up bad assets from financial firms. And Reid acknowledged he and other Democrats are hearing from voters, and voters are not happy.
People in Searchlight, Nevada, I've gotten emails from Searchlight. Stan Colton, he wrote me an email. He's former the treasurer of the state of Nevada. He knows what he's talking about. He said, this is the goofiest thing I ever heard. Why don't you guys get out of there and come back and let's let the markets go? I disagree with him. But what I'm saying is it's very unpopular. Is this pleasant work? No, it's not pleasant work. Look what's happening in the calls coming into our offices and our emails. People are very unhappy with what we're doing. But we believe we have an obligation to the country, and that is Wall Street and Main Street.
Gail Chadwick is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, they're hearing from Americans that they do not want this bailout. And yet Democrats said today, we feel we have to respond to the Secretary of the Treasury. So what's the sense there? What's the mood in Washington?
Well, it's almost a complete role reversal. That's what's interesting about it. If you kind of put tape over the labels, I don't know that you could tell who were the Democrats and who were the Republicans. You'd probably get it wrong. But I think that there are elements of this that are that really have been widely misunderstood. One of them is that the only obstacle to the bill are House Republicans, who, as Democrats said, blew up a meeting yesterday by introducing a plan with an entirely different premise.
And I'm going to stop you there for a second, because some of our listeners, Gail Chadwick, in some of our Western time zone stations heard you yesterday break the news that, in fact, these House Republicans wanted to propose an alternative plan that is one we've also talked about here on the program, and we're going to talk about it more in a few minutes when we turn to the economy. But they're proposing that the government actually offer insurance on this bad debt instead of buying it out, instead of the government buying it out. And this is definitely a sticking point, but go on, you're saying.
Well, I think what has not surfaced yet and what did in Senator Reid's comment is that there are Democrats that are also very alarmed about this bill. Senator Harkin gave a stemwinder of a speech today saying he just doesn't believe in helping Wall Street first. We really have to help Main Street first. Now, I think what that signals is not that Democrats will vote against the bill, but that they will have a powerful bargaining tool with this president in the last days and weeks of this administration to get a lot more than they otherwise might have, such as a whole second stimulus bill devoted directly to Main Street.
Well, Gail, I just want to interrupt again for another second to say that later in the program, we're going to hear from a small businessman who says that helping Wall Street does help Main Street because it loosens up the cash that he needs for credit. So it sounds as if there's just sort of a lack of trust in the explanation of how this is all going to work.
Well, I think one problem is the term bailout. That wasn't the administration's original concept, and to the extent that they've used it, I think they realize it's a big mistake, because it does sound like you're giving a gift only to a small number of people, when the secretary's real argument is, we're talking about whether or not you can buy a car. We're talking about whether your local McDonald's has money to get frozen fries next week. That this, when a financial system melts down, it affects all of us. We're all in this together. That is an argument they're making now, but late, and it hasn't really settled into public thought yet.
Well, and you asked earlier this morning when we were talking to you, how did we get to this point? And I think you're talking politically. What is your thought on, do you have an answer?
I think the Democrats, when they saw, remember, all this has just been a week, Thursday evening when the Treasury Secretary said, this is a crisis, if we don't do something quickly, the markets will melt down. Democrats knew, in charge of the Congress, they didn't want to be saddled with the meltdown of the U.S. financial system. But nor did they want to bear the entire brunt of it. So what they've tried to do all along is said, look, we are going to not come up with our own plan, we're going to take the secretary's plan and improve it, but he's responsible for its results, not us. And we're not going to bring it to the floor unless there's a critical mass of Republicans. We're not going to take this on ourselves. Now, I think what happened today is that Democrats have decided that even if House Republicans don't go with them, they will take it on themselves, but they're going to demand a lot more from the Bush administration as a price for doing it.
And just briefly, Gail, John McCain is saying that he is going to attend the debates tonight in Mississippi. A couple days ago when he made the announcement he was going to Washington, analysts we talked to said that whether or not he had anything to do once he got there, the fact is that it was a smart political move because voters thought someone was doing something. How is McCain being viewed today?
It's hard to find anyone who speaks positively of his role in the last 24 hours. I think it created, you know, Democrats are saying he spoke at the meeting, we don't even understand what he said, we were nearing a deal, he blew it up. In fact, I don't think he had that much of a role at all. House Republicans were well on this path before he came, and in fact, they're mad at him too for not endorsing their approach more emphatically than he did, yeah, or at all.
Well, we should say, though, you know, what we're hearing from people, you know, who may be prone to voting for John McCain anyway, is that they, at least it worked in the heartland. We'll see if that stays the same, too, as the days go on. Gail Chadha, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks, as always.
You're welcome.
So that's Washington. How's Wall Street? For economic understanding, we turn to Philip Kogan. He's capital markets editor for The Economist magazine. He's watching all of this from London. And, Philip, the basic question Americans have is this bailout really necessary? I mean, it's one of many questions. Yesterday, Senator Richard Shelby, a Republican, dramatically exited a meeting saying that he had letters from top analysts at Harvard and elsewhere telling him the bailout wasn't necessary. So Americans are confused. What's the preponderance of thinking?
The preponderance of thinking is that some sort of plan is definitely necessary. What we're seeing is a loss of confidence in the banks, and we saw Washington Mutual effectively go bust last night, had to be bought by JP Morgan. You can't survive with many of those kind of failures in a row, and in the markets, it's just costing an enormous amount for banks to borrow money.
By the way, I want to stop you just there and
yeah,
ask, for people who might suddenly be waking up to this news or whatever, that WaMu failed and was bought. Just briefly, that doesn't affect people who have their money in the bank. I mean, the bank failed, but it was absorbed by another. And so for people who bank there, that they're not going to feel any difference.
No, J.P. Morgan has now taken over the bank, but J.P. Morgan has already taken over Bear Stearns this year, and we can't rely on J.P. Morgan to bail out every bank that gets into trouble. So that's lucky on that part, but we can't carry on with the system declining in that kind of way.
And because it is freezing credit, we understand, we're going to talk later in the program with how that's impacting, you know, Main Street, but freezing credit, why?
Well, the difficulty is you think of the banks as a kind of plumbing of the financial system that channels money from savers to borrowers, and the money's getting stuck in the middle. And a bit like the sewers, which you never notice until they go wrong, there's an almighty stench arising. And because the banks have to pay an awful lot to borrow money, or indeed they can't get money for longer than overnight, they're not going to be able to lend money out to companies, to consumers, and that's going to be very difficult. And at the very least, they're going to have to pass on higher rates to companies and consumers at just the time when they're already struggling, facing their gas bills, maybe losing their jobs. So it's very bad news for the economy.
So, Philip, you're saying that the preponderance of thinking is that something has to happen. The markets can't just sort this out themselves. But what about the idea that was floated that the U.S. government become an insurance agency? And again, Lawrence Kotlikoff explained this on our program. We'll have it on our website, here-now.org, so you can listen back. But basically, the idea that the government, the U.S. government would say, we'll back the loans to encourage others to buy them and also maybe to sort out the market by putting value on the bad debt that the U.S. will then back. What's the thinking about that plan?
Well, as long as you understand that in practical terms, it's no difference from buying the loans. If you've insured the loans at a certain price, then you will have to buy them if they go wrong. So you might still be in the hole for $700 billion if that's the case. And of course, then the question is, how much are you charging for the insurance? And if you charge a lot for the insurance, then that very payment could be the thing that makes banks go bust. what you're talking about there is potentially taking capital away from the banks at the very moment when they're short of it.
In other words, for them to go and buy it, they need cash to even do that. And
for them to buy the insurance, exactly.
Speaking, though, of cash and banks, the New York Times reports today, and this may be part of what you're talking about, the idea of a credit freeze. The reports there are that banks are hoarding cash.
Yes, exactly, because they don't know what hits might occur to them next. They have no desire to lend it out to other people if they think they might need it themselves. And the problem is, of course, that the strongest banks are all right in that system, but the weakest ones really suffer. And as I say, this can happen for a few days or a week or two, but it can't happen in the long term. Something has to be done. In Europe today, we did have banks step in to lend money to banks for a month and 3 months to try and get over the problem. But, of course, they'll have to pay it back after a month and 3 months. So that's just a short-term solution, a Band-Aid. It's not a long-term answer.
So this is scary talk. And as we have seen over the last week and a half, scary talk creates worse headlines. You know, it's just sort of a self-fulfilling. We start getting caught in this idea of, gee, there's no money. Should I take my money? And I'm wondering, Philip Kogan, what should people do now? FDR had an insurance plan. He came up with, FDIC, which insured, I needed to be reminded what that was, the FDIC, which insured banks and said there's nothing to fear but fear itself. Is the thinking that if something happens, if the government does something, it will generate that kind of optimism?
Yes, unfortunately, nobody has the money to buy the kind of assets that the banks want to sell at the moment. The only person who can possibly have that money is the government because it has no effective constraint. So that's the situation we've reached. Now, foreign countries don't want to buy U.S. banks' assets, and domestic investors don't want to do it. So the role has fallen to the government, and I understand why people don't want to bail out banks. But unfortunately, if you make the banks go bust, you're just cutting off your nose to spite your face. Everybody will suffer.
As you're watching this from London, are you confident that there will be some form of a bailout? As if people missed it, Democratic Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says there will be a vote tomorrow at 10:30. Do you think that there will be a bailout after that?
I have to believe, for the sake of us all, that some plan comes up, because if we don't have some kind of plan to restore confidence in the banks, then obviously the economic damage could be very severe.
And would an incremental plan, let's say maybe not $700 billion or $70 billion, but maybe $100 billion?
That might not be enough. It depends on the latitude given to the government. The problem is the U.S. political system. Of course, they go home tomorrow or the next day, and they're not back till January. So you need to give the Treasury Secretary a bit of latitude to try and work with things during the 3 months that everybody's off.
And by the way, Philip Kogan, again, a capital markets editor for The Economist, watching all of this from London, has said you're well aware Americans are leery of just responding once again to a government asking it to do something, given what happened in the march up to the war in Iraq. But he's saying something has to happen. And Philip Kogan also saying that on the other side of this, you're a free market guy, but there's going to be more regulations in the U.S. just in the few seconds we have?
Yes, definitely. The banks will have to pay for this in years to come.
Philip, thank you so much for your advice today. We'll turn to you again.
Thank you.
And we also learned today the debates are on tonight. We'll hear what that means in Mississippi in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, the McCain campaign has announced that John McCain will join Barack Obama in Oxford, Mississippi for tonight's first presidential debate. It's an event that school officials and students at the University of Mississippi hope will erase another historical image. That was back in 1962 when armed federal marshals escorted 29-year-old James Meredith, the first black student to attend Ole Miss, as he walked in for the first day of school. Rioting broke out 40 years ago this month over that court-ordered admission of the first black student to Ole Miss. Tonight, the first African-American presidential nominee, Barack Obama, will be guarded by Secret Service agents as he arrives in Oxford. Obama has said he'll turn the debate into a town hall if John McCain does not show, but we know John McCain has pledged he will. What else might happen? Curtis Wilkie is professor of journalism at the Overby Center for Southern Journalism and Politics at the University of Mississippi. A longtime reporter for the Boston Globe, he covered 8 presidential campaigns and was a student at Ole Miss when James Meredith arrived in 1962. Curtis Wilkie joins us from Oxford. Curtis, welcome.
Thank you.
And first of all, sigh of relief now that John McCain has said the debates are on.
Everybody feels much better as of about an hour ago.
Because give us a sense. We understand a couple million were spent by the school to get ready. The school had changed classes today. And, of course, there was the overarching thought that it might change an image. Tell us how the school was anticipating this.
Well, the school, invested over $5 million altogether. At least, they were able to gather that much money from people who support the university. It's private money, but the school wanted the debate for 2 reasons. One, simply to host it, just like any other university who applies to host one of these. But secondly, and importantly for Ole Miss, was to try to redo our image nationally, which probably still suffers in some circles for what took place here in 1962.
Well, as you said, the school has changed much since then. Black enrollment is up. Black and white students obviously intermingle more, but some black students in particular say there are still issues. People still seeing Dixie, for instance, at the football games. But you were there in 1962. What are your memories of what happened?
If people don't like it today, they should have seen it when I was here. The band, their uniforms were, faux Confederate uniforms and that sort of thing. So much of that, officially is gone. The Confederate battle flag, to the extent it can be banned, it is, that people still have First Amendment rights, but it's been discouraged. We're not perfect. We don't claim to be, but, I think if you went to BU or Harvard, you'd see, black students hanging out with black students. You see self-segregation, but just compared to where we were 46 years ago, it's a very gratifying change.
Right, and I want to get your thoughts on that, but first just to remind other people, here's President Kennedy in a televised address to the nation the night before James Meredith was supposed to start classes, and this is Kennedy appealing to students to uphold the law. Hold on, we're going to listen. Go ahead. Well, maybe we don't. Do we have Kennedy? Oh, well, I'll just paraphrase. This is when Kennedy famously said, "The eyes of the nation and all the world are upon you and all of us, and the honor of your university and state are in the balance." But as you know, Curtis Wilkie, even as Kennedy was saying those words, rioting was breaking out.
It had just broken out, and Kennedy didn't know that it had broken out. It had broken out a minute or two before he actually began that speech, and I know that I was trying to escape the tear gas and was in the lobby of a girl's dorm when I saw Kennedy's visage on an old black and white television set. And there he was making this appeal, and it was already going on. It was a shameful period in the university's history and the state's history. It tarnished the school, and to some extent, we've been living it down ever since.
Well, in fact, James Meredith spoke to the BBC about his memories of that day. Of course, he had to walk through the debris of the writing to register for class. We remember the black and white photos, this dignified 29-year-old Air Force veteran in a suit and tie. Here are his reflections on that time.
If there was any surprise to me, is that only 2 people got killed and 300 or 400 got hurt. I mean, that was the only surprise to me. And for my whole time there, my biggest surprise, I was still living.
Curtis Wilkie, in that weird way that history has of not being so tidy, we understand that James Meredith's politics took a sharp turn after that time. He became a Republican and worked for Senator Jesse Helms, but quit that job. He said Helms was too liberal. He went very far to the right and is not coming tonight to commemorate another black walking into the school, this time as a presidential candidate. It's just a kind of an odd twist on the story.
Yeah, he's not the kind of guy you would expect him to be. He's a conservative Republican. He doesn't like civil rights organizations. He endorsed David Duke, the Ku Klux Klansman who ran for governor at that notorious campaign in Louisiana in 1991. He even campaigned in the 60s for Ross Barnett, the very governor who had tried to prevent him from coming to Ole Miss.
Well,
but saying all that, you know, Meredith is a very courageous figure, and he's been honored here on this campus. There's a statue of Meredith mm-hmm. and the Civil Rights Memorial on this campus.
And he has a right to choose to think whatever he thinks.
Absolutely, and yeah. He'd be welcome here if he came. He's a yeah. big Ole Miss supporter. You'll see him wearing Ole Miss sweatshirts and caps, and he's donated all his papers to the university. He is not a liberal Democrat.
Which actually makes a pretty interesting story. Curtis Wilkie, professor of journalism at the University of Mississippi, who's written fabulously interesting stories over his many decades as a journalist and is now at Ole Miss waiting with everyone there for tonight's debates. Curtis, we wish you well tonight.
Thank you. Great to hear from Boston again.
Thank you. Well, of course, we're going to be following all the economic news for you today, but with that in mind, when we come back after the news, we're going to have a view of the economy from Main Street. And it's not pretty. That's after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. To recap our top story, the Bush administration says the $700 billion bailout of the financial industry is needed to unclog the nation's credit arteries. An analyst in today's New York Times puts it this way: the credit crunch is having an extraordinarily negative impact on the brick-and-mortar economy. He goes on to say, we're not talking about the highfalutin fat cat Wall Streeters. This is about whether your hospital gets a new wing. Well, is that true? Are small business owners feeling this? We've been touching down with people across the country on the economy, and today we go to Tomball, Texas. That's where we find Doc Cohen. He's in the business of opening new franchises. That's what he does for the Great American Cookie Company, Coffee Beanery, and Pretzel Time. Right now, he has 29 locations in regional malls with 300 employees and about $10 million in sales. And, Doc, we understand you began to feel an impact of the credit crunch after news broke that Bank of America was buying the failing Merrill Lynch company last week. So what is your relationship with Merrill Lynch, and how did that news affect you?
We've had an outstanding relationship with Merrill Lynch ever since we started our business some 8 years ago, and how it affected us is it dried up our credit. We have a revolving credit line. We've asked Merrill Lynch to increase that line of credit to enable us to open 3 new locations. And what they've said to us essentially is, hey, things have changed, and in order for us to lend you $500,000, we want you to put $1 million into your accounts at Merrill Lynch. But if I'm going to tie up that million there to borrow $500,000, there's no need for me to borrow the $500,000. I might as well just use the funds that are on hand, and
right. Those
are our reserve funds.
People might say, well, okay, you're opening franchises. You could put it on hold. But opening a franchise for you isn't like putting an addition on a house. This is how you make your money, right?
Well, not only is this how we make our money, but this is how everyday Americans make their money as a result of me growing my business. I mean, I'm going to open 3 locations. Those 3 locations, first of all, will employ at least 30 and up to 50 people. Those people are supporting their families. And then you've got everybody who supplies those 3 businesses. I mean, the milkman who brings us our milk, the driver of the truck who brings us our paper supplies, the fact that we buy our cookie dough from our Atlanta facility and all the people who work there who produce that cookie dough for us, the trucker who brings it to us, the gas station who sells that trucker his fuel on the way down here. I mean, this is everyday Americans who are getting hurt by this. It's not just Wall Street versus Main Street. This is America here. This is what drives our economy.
If there is no infusion of cash, some analysts are saying that what is now sort of a frozen credit market will really be, well, hell will really freeze over. It will be completely frozen. What does that do for someone like you?
Well, we won't open those 3 stores, and I've got 2 more that have been proposed. So they're 3 to 5 stores that we won't open, 50 to 75 people who won't get jobs, And we will just continue to operate what we have until the credit market makes it possible for us to continue to grow. So what happens is our growth stops.
And what does that do to your ongoing business?
If you don't grow in a business, you tend to shrivel up and die. I mean, we need to create opportunities for our people. Those people want to advance. As we grow, they have opportunities to become managers and district managers and regional managers. And that's what happens. We just don't grow anymore. And then, listen, look at the income taxes that we pay. Look at the sales taxes that we pay. Look at the income taxes that all of our employees pay. All this is what drives the economy. And you know what? We're a credit-worthy borrower. We didn't create this problem. And we don't borrow more than we can afford to borrow. So now what's happening is people who did borrow more than they could afford to borrow could impact us. And what we need to see is for the Congress, the people we elected to solve our country's problems up there, I'm looking to have them act in a bipartisan way. I don't care if they're Democrats or Republicans. It doesn't matter to me. What I want them to do is what's best for the country.
Do you know what that is?
Well, I want them to relieve the credit problem that we have with all of these underperforming loans. And my view of this, and, you know, I'm not an economist. I only know what I read and what I understand as a businessman. It seems to me that the government is going to buy up a great many mortgages and other forms of debt that are in arrears, not current, and that there is an opportunity there for them to get that money back. And from what the president said, there's a good opportunity to get that money back. Now, if I'm an investor and I can go out and buy a mortgage for 10 cents on the dollar, thinking that a year or two from now I might sell it for 20 cents on the dollar, I might look at that as a pretty good investment. So while I recognize the risk that the taxpayer may be on the hook for some of this, I don't believe the taxpayer is going to lose $700 billion in the end.
So you're for Henry Paulson's proposed bailout and the Bush administration bailout, but, you know, what about the thinking of the breakaway House Republicans who are saying, no, I don't want the money, we don't want the money to go out directly, we would rather have the government insure the bad debt, let other people buy it and deal it and take the risk on it. What do you think about the alternative plan?
Well, I'm not an expert enough to determine which of the two plans is the better plan. What I know is I need them to do something. I need them to do something decisive, and I need them to do something in a relatively quick fashion. I don't want this to drag on for months. And what worries me is I don't want to see typical politics get involved here and have individual members tacking on provisions to benefit certain things or projects that they may want to try to get onto this bill in order to get it passed when they might not otherwise get it passed.
And you need government to help you now.
We need the credit market freed up so that I can do what I do best, and that is borrow money responsibly, create new opportunities for people, create new jobs, buy more products from the supply chain, and keep the economy moving. That's what I do as a Main Street businessman.
Well, Doc, what would you say, first of all, to other Americans who don't want any kind of bailout? They either see it as bailing out people who made bad decisions about mortgages and are about to foreclose, and in fact there's nothing in any bailout suggestions for people who are in foreclosure, so that's not true, or they see it as bailing out fat cats on Wall Street who don't deserve it. What would you want to say to them? Because these people aren't thinking about you.
No, they're not. They're thinking that I'm sitting in a corner office on the 50th floor of a building in New York, and I'm not. I'm sitting here in Tomball, Texas, in a small building, in a small office, trying to run a small business that employs mainstream Americans. That's what we do here.
And Doc Cohen, just one last thought. There you are in Tomball, Texas, 30 miles north of Houston, an area recovering from the hurricane. So you already got hit hard.
We got hit very hard. We're very fortunate. We had no loss of life or injury. But our businesses certainly suffered. And I have to tell you, Robin, that we paid our people, even though our stores were closed. And we will not recover that. So we're here helping everyday people make a living. Yes, we make a living as well. We wouldn't go into business if we weren't able to make a profit. But we have 300 people who depend on us to put food on their tables, gasoline in their cars. We're a responsible employer. We are not going to go and borrow more than we can afford to pay. That's what makes our economy go.
That's Doc Cohen of Tomball, Texas. His business is opening franchises for other companies. Doc, thank you so much for speaking with us, and best of luck to you.
Well, thank you.
And he explained how many small businesses across America, in fact, most, rely on credit to stay afloat, and we'll hear from more of them in the coming days. You're listening to Here and Now. Dexter returns to Showtime this Sunday for its third season. Like many cop and robber series, it's set in a Miami police department, and like all those CSI shows, it focuses on a forensics expert. Dexter Morgan, played by Michael C. Hall of 6 Feet Under fame, is a blood splatter specialist, to be sure, but the twist is he's also a murderer. Joining us is Here and Now critic at large Ed Siegel with something of a guilty smile on his face. So HBO giving us mob bosses and sympathetic bigamists and vampires that we like, and it looks like Showtime is going to be giving us what? A sympathetic serial murderer?
A sympathetic serial killer, right. And, you know, the reason that you root for him is because he's witty, resourceful, and introspective, and in his own way, Robin, as moral as they come.
Okay, well, now that you've got everyone's attention, I know you like the show.
Yeah, I do. Here's the backstory. In the first season, we see that Dexter witnesses the brutal murder of his mother, and he ends up being adopted by the policeman on the case. That cop noticed that the boy was more than a bit perverse, so he teaches Dexter to use his evil leanings only for doing good. Kind of a perverse Batman.
Right.
So like his adoptive sister, Dexter joins the Miami Metro Police Department, where he gets inside information on murderers, sexual predators, and nice folks like that who he goes out and kills.
So it's another vigilante cop.
If it were only that, it wouldn't be any more interesting than all the other vigilante cops, but it's a real ensemble show. The policemen here are is interesting, more interesting than they were on Hill Street Blues or any of those shows. And it mixes the personal and the professional, or the normal and the abnormal, as well as any show on TV.
Well, I know you have a scene. Let's listen. In this one, Dexter goes to a yoga class with his girlfriend, played by Julie Benz.
Right.
We are strong warriors, all of us.
This is absolutely, without a doubt, the worst moment of my life.
Now let's go into a little free-form yoga. Just let yourself dance.
I was wrong. This is.
See the dust dancing against the sunlight. Be as beautiful as the golden flakes of dust, Dexter.
I could probably kill her before anyone realized what happened.
So we really is essentially a serial murderer, only he murders bad guys at a yoga class.
Well, without giving too much away, the yoga instructor survives.
Well, we understand that Jimmy Smits is on the show, which again draws other comparisons to other cop shows in the past.
Right. Here's what happens. Dexter goes off to kill a drug dealer who murdered two young women. But another guy gets in the way, and Dexter ends up killing him instead. The guy he kills turns out to be a high school coach who's something of a hero and whose brother is the assistant district attorney played by Smits. Hmm. The Smits character, in turn, suspects the drug dealer of killing his brother, not Dexter, and so he identifies Dexter as a kindred spirit and eventually a friend.
Let's listen.
It's like, couldn't you, I only have one person I can trust anymore.
Yourself.
I was thinking of you.
Oh.
Oh, don't worry. I know that trust doesn't come too easy to you.
Is it that obvious?
Well, to me, I can just see that you're used to carrying your secrets to yourself.
You might be able to tell by Smits's accent that he's playing a Cuban-American. And that's another thing that Dexter does really well, is it delves into the new melting pot of various ethnicities in around Miami, complete with a culture clash that comes with it.
Well, I'm thinking, too, it's sort of like, The Office, if The Office were about a murderer, because if he's turning and looking
right.
at the camera and having an internal life. So you know, where does it rate, though, in your book of these kinds of shows?
I'd put it right behind The Sopranos and maybe right ahead of Mad Men.
Really?
Yeah. I think of all the shows that are on TV right now, that it would be my desert island pick.
Well, we're hoping you don't have to go to a desert island. And if you do, that you get Showtime there. It's a pay-per-view, right?
That's right.
That's Here and Now critic-at-large Ed Siegel on his new favorite show, Dexter, which premieres its third season on Showtime this Sunday. Ed, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, in a minute, a cappella syncopation.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Here at our mothership, our home station, WBUR in Boston, we hold an annual reading of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol for our listeners. It's a crowd favorite. And between the readings, musical interludes featuring the a cappella group Syncopation.
Do-a, do-a, do-a.
Well, I hope they're not too busy this year because Syncopation has just released a new CD, Wonderful You.
You'd be so kind to let me see how you do what you do. Wonderful You.
And joining us in the studio is Syncopation, soprano Aubrey Logan and alto Christine Fossen. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
And also tenor David Thorne Scott. And bass Sunenori or Lee Abe. Welcome to you both as well.
Thanks for having us.
And Lee, I want to start with you because you founded Syncopation. You've been with us through all these years of the Charles Dickens readings, too. And you were a member, I understand, of a Japanese boy band, Baby Boo.
Yeah.
what kind of music was that?
It was like pop music. 95% of the audience was like girls and like singing and dancing at the same time, that kind of thing.
And then you came to the Berklee College of Music here in Boston and founded Syncopation. Now, tell us a little bit about, you know, why an a cappella group? Because we know they're wildly popular on college campuses, but what was your goal?
Well, you know, that was my full-time job when I was in Japan singing a vocal group, and then I always wanted to pursue this career and I wanted to have one step higher or two steps higher, you know. So that's why I decided to search for some good singers here in Boston, and then I found them.
And you found a number of them over the years. I mean, we should say there's been different members of Syncopation. But Christine, you joined in 2003. And what drew you?
I grew up singing harmonies with my family. And singing harmonies is one of my favorite things to do as a musician. And I heard Syncopation. I listened to their demo and I thought, I would love to join this group.
Yeah.
And I love Lee's arrangement, so.
Well, we want to hear a little more of that sound. So would you please just do a little bit of Route 66 for us? Let's listen.
One, two.
If you ever plan to motor west, travel my way, take the highway, that's the best. I get your kicks on Route 66, Scudidlabepopia. It winds from Chicago to LA. More than 2,000 miles all the way. Get your kicks on Route 66. Get your kicks on Route 66.
Yeah, yeah.
Get your kicks on Route 66.
Now, Aubrey and David, I want you to jump in here as well, because we watched you rehearse. And you are really honest with each other. You know? Like, Christine would say, I don't like that, or you did this. And Aubrey would say, I need this. And, I mean, is that a part of singing a cappella, Aubrey?
It certainly is. If we're not honest with each other, we're just not going to get a good sound out of each other. Fortunately, we're in a group where we can be honest with one another and not get hard feelings.
David, it's so raw in some ways. You know, if you're in a choir, you can blend a little bit and cover up a mistake. But in a four-part a cappella group,
that's what I love about it. You know, there's nowhere to hide, and you're the one responsible for the sound. And one on a part, that's the way to go.
Yeah. Well, let's listen. You sing lead on a cover of the Mr. 80s hit, Broken Wings. Let's listen.
Take these broken wings and learn to fly again. Learn to live so free.
Now, that's really pretty. But also well-known. You know, so Lee, back to you with the arrangements. You know, when you do covers of Joni Mitchell's Both Sides Now, Earth, Wind & Fire's Getaway, and here you are arranging them. I mean, there's an expectation in the audience that it's going to sound a certain way.
Yeah, but, you know, I always let's see, like, if you see something round, you know, and then I sometimes want to see, like, square, you know, and that's some beauty about arranging, you know. You look at things differently, and then all of a sudden you found some other kind of beauty.
Well, especially since some of these are pop hits, and you take them through a jazz harmony.
We all grew up on pop music, and jazz has always been about taking available music and turning it into something different, so that's what we do with this group, and that's what Lee does with the arrangements.
Now, I want to say, too, that you all also play instruments. Two play trombone, two play trumpet. Just give us a little taste of the an instrumental piece. So now, Christine, I've watched you sing for many years, and in your face there's almost no consciousness that you are a person. You are an instrument up there. I mean, you are listening so closely. I'm imagining that playing something like the trumpet helps you sing the way that you sing as an instrument.
Absolutely. In fact, a lot of times when I'm sight-reading the music that Lee brings in, I'm fingering my trumpet valves in the air. Actually, the trumpet is in my register of voice, too, as well, so that works out.
Because you're the alto.
Yeah.
It's just a continuation. You just don't happen to have the trumpet while you're singing.
Sure.
Well, Lee, I want to make sure we've played one of your pieces. You do covers on the new CD, but also what piece of yours, I Can Fly. And tell me a little bit about this song.
This song is all about, you know, you go through some hardship, but, you know, after the hardship, then you always come to some shiny moment again. And then because of those hardships, then you can appreciate things more, you know, deeply.
I can fly.
I can fly.
I can fly.
If I try.
If I try.
I can fly.
I just want to ask you, what's the status of a cappella groups? You know, you go online, and I went to primarilyacapellasingers.com, and you can listen to Rosa Mommen from Finland, and there's Sentimento Pentimento from Italy, and all these different. So it's huge, you know, in many ways. But in other ways, it's like, you know, you don't see it on the charts, you know? So right. Where do you fit in?
Well, we try to sort of straddle these two worlds. You know, the a cappella world has its own competitions. We won the Harmony Sweepstakes for Boston this year and went to the Nationals. So we are in that world, but then we also had to be in the jazz world as well. Most of our performances are with piano, bass, and drums. Mm. So we're trying to have something for everybody. We think of ourselves as a vocal group more than an a cappella group.
We want to go out with one of your songs, and you picked your version of Radiohead's High and Dry. It's interesting to us that it's Radiohead because this is a group that's really trying to get music, you know, sort of over the heads of the music business
exactly.
Out to people.
Sure. Well, any independent musician nowadays has to take inspiration from that because the old major label thing doesn't work so well for most of us.
David Thorne Scott. We've also been speaking with Tsunanori Abe, Christine Fossen, and Aubrey Logan of the group Syncopation. Thank you to all of you. And to hear a live performance of High and Dry, or for more information about Syncopation, go to our website, here-now.org.
Don't leave me dry.